Welcome, welcome, welcome to another episode of Cyrus's podcast. Today, I have my good friend, Michelle Harrington. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
I appreciate you. You know, I'm like, I think you're one of the most, like, the biggest badasses in the world. So I'm like super excited to finally have you on the podcast. For those of you that don't know, Michelle's the CEO of the number one independent brokerage here in California.
Yep.
And First Team. And so I'm really excited to have you on. We know where you're at now, but I think the more interesting thing is how you got here. Like, wow. All the way back, you know? Because some people, I think, see like the end picture and they don't see like what it took to get there. Mm-hmm. And I know that story, and I want to share that, and I actually want to dive a little deeper into it. So, like, before real estate, you know, now you run this amazing real estate company. Before that, what did you do?
Before I got into real estate, I was in the United States Marine Corps, and I worked on C-130 engines. So C-130s are like they call them Fat Albert at the air show. They're the planes with the four turboprops and a cute little nose. And they transport troops and refuel F-18s or F-16s or fighter jets.
Wow.
And so that's what I did.
Wait, so why did you join the Marines? Like was there like a, was it like I always grew up wanting to be in the Marines, or was it like?
Yeah, that was partially it. I was always a tomboy, grew up playing sports. You know, I loved that kind of like competitive aggressiveness. And I always idolized the Marine Corps and always thought I wanted to be in law enforcement eventually. And so I never even thought about the Army, the Navy, or the Air Force. So it wasn't even like it was just the Marine Corps or nothing. And one day I was at college, I was going to Rutgers University in New Jersey.
Okay.
And I just decided, like, probably out of boredom, because I do some crazy things out of boredom sometimes, to just go down and see it, talk to a recruiter. So I went down and talked to a recruiter, and I said, I want to go in reserves because I'm in college and I don't want to drop out of college. And he's like, you don't have to drop out of college to go in active duty. He was the best objection handler I've ever met in my life, my recruiter.
Wow.
And I said, okay, but I don't really want to leave the East Coast. I don't want to leave New Jersey. And because my dad's here, and I wanted to be close to him. And he said, oh, you can get stationed on the East Coast. And I was like, oh, okay. And I said, okay, so I can still go to school. I can be stationed on the East Coast. He's like, yeah, we can do all that for you, and you can go into active duty. So I was like, wow, okay, well, I guess I really don't have any more objections. So I said, all right, sign me up. So they make you take an ASVAB, which is like your proficiency.
Okay.
In, you know, how smart you are or whatever. And I did good enough that I could kind of pick any job I wanted, which doesn't mean a whole lot in the military, but, you know, it was good enough. So I went down the list and I was like, I want to be a helicopter machine door gunner. And they're like, oh, no, you can't. We don't let women do that. I was like, okay, I want to be a grunt. They were like, no, sorry, can't do that. And I was like going down the list of everything I wanted to do. And there was like nothing I wanted to do was available for me to do.
Yeah.
So I was like, I'm not going to join the Marine Corps and be stuck behind a desk. Like, there's no way.
Yeah.
You know, find me something I can do where I'm, you know, doing Marine Corps shit. And he said, well, you can work on aircraft. And I was like, okay, yeah, let's do that. And that was
so
it.
So that's how you ended up.
I signed up for the Marine Corps and I became a mechanic.
So I actually didn't know that that was what you did in the Marine Corps. So that's actually really cool. But so you were going to, what were you studying at university?
I was studying criminal justice because I did think eventually I did want to be a police officer.
Yeah.
So criminal justice, social science, you know, that kind of stuff. That was.
So did you end up finishing college?
I did.
Okay.
So, and this was, me joining was very disappointing to my dad and my dad's side of the family are all kind of like academics, PhDs and master's degrees and, you know, professors at universities. And my cousins are scientists at Stanford University, two of them,
yeah.
Two of my cousins.
Oh, wow.
So very like highly educated family on my dad's side. But my dad decided for some crazy reason to be a social worker. So I got the the short end of the stick. You know, he was going to school to be a dentist, and I'm like, why didn't you be a dentist? Damn it. I'm like, great, I'm the daughter of a social worker. So
big money in that.
Yeah, business. Big money. Anyway, when I did decide that I was leaving school to join the Marine Corps, he was like, Michelle, you know, people leave school, they never finish school. Like, you're not gonna finish. Now you're basically dropping out, you're giving up on college. And he believed in, you know, going to college strongly. So I was like, Dad, don't worry, I'll finish, you know, one way or the other. And it was really, really hard. So my recruiter lied to me, believe it or not. It wasn't so easy to be a Marine and go to college at the same time.
Yeah.
I mean, your commanding officers and your sergeants, and they don't give a crap like what kind of education you want. They want you there doing your job. And I couldn't even get out like a book if I had downtime, like in the shop, because all the planes were out flying or something like that. If I got out a college book, my sergeant would say, put away that book, go get a tech pub and learn how to fix C-130s. I mean, they didn't want any part of that.
Yeah.
So it wasn't easy to study and go to school. And then every time you got deployed, you had to drop your classes and get deployed. Or you got, you know, I was at three different duty stations in my 4 years. And so it was hard to be at one school. So, but I did, when I got transferred to El Toro, which was my final duty station, there was a college on base that was run by Chapman University. And it was really like, I think maybe three different professors that came in to teach us. And it was amazing, super small classroom, all Marines. Maybe there was like 20 of us. And so it was amazing. And the professors were all like, they weren't just academics. They were, they were like retired military people.
Oh, wow.
You know? So we learned, you know, like it was much more geared towards the military. It was like terrorism and, you know, religion and, you know, things like that was what we studied, and it was great. And then I graduated from Chapman University right after I got out of the Marine Corps.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. And so you graduated, so you got out of the Marine Corps, you graduated, then what'd you do?
So while I was in the Marine Corps, I do a lot of things at the same time.
Yeah.
I'm like a big multitasker. While I was in the Marine Corps, actually the first, I had this like entrepreneurial spirit that I never really knew I had. And when I was little, now looking back on it, like I used to start these little businesses when I was like a little kid, and I would like make crafts and try to sell them like at a craft show. I was just, you know, this kind of feeling I had of always wanting to create stuff and be independent. And so while I was in the Marine Corps, I loved animals. And I thought, like probably halfway through my military enlistment, I was like, I really don't want to work for anybody. This is crazy, the amount of control they have on your life. And I really didn't kind of differentiate between the control that the military had on my life or control of a regular job. Now I know the control you have at a regular job is much different. So I loved animals. I thought, I want a pet store, but I don't have any money. So I started a pet food delivery service. And so So I would go and do if I was on day crew, I would, you know, get off at like 6 o'clock. I would go pick up pet food and I would deliver it to people that were my customers at like delivered their pet food and had a markup of like hardly anything.
So how did you like, how did that come? Like what brought that idea to be like, oh, I should deliver pet food?
Well, I wanted a pet store, but I couldn't afford it.
Okay.
So I was like, what can I do that's animal related and maybe build this little business?
Yeah.
So I called it Pet Foods Express, and I ran ads in the Penny Saver, and people would call me and say, I want my pet food delivered. And I would say, what kind of food do you have? Oh, we have Nutro Natural Choice for my, we get 40 pounds every 2 weeks.
What?
I was like, perfect. Put you on the 40 pounds every 2 weeks, Nutro Natural Choice, and I'll deliver it. And I would.
You were doing Uber Eats before.
So I was delivering dog food in my off time.
Wow. Okay. So that's crazy. So that was during when you were in the Marine Corps. And then you graduated, and then you continued doing that?
No. So that was not making any money. Like sometimes I was trying to match the retailer and just like have a markup, like buy it wholesale, sell it retail. But a lot of the places wouldn't sell it to retail unless you had like a brick and mortar store. So sometimes I couldn't even get retail. So I was doing it like at a break even just to like get customers.
Yeah.
So I ended up selling my customer list to Bow Wow Chow. And they ended up taking over my customer list, and I was out of the pet food delivery business.
Oh my God.
And then I was like, okay, I need another business that makes more money.
Yeah.
And at the time, I bought a condo while I was in the military and on a VA loan. And it was, I bought it from the builder, but I had an agent representing me. So he really didn't do much work because you know, when you buy it from a builder, it's kind of like, you don't do that
you
much
just
work.
Sign the paperwork and
And then I saw his commission. I think it was like, it was like $145,000 condo. So I don't know, his commission might've been like $4,000 or $5,000. And I was like, holy mackerel, he made $4,000 or $5,000. Like, that's crazy.
Yeah.
So I was like, that's the business I need to be in.
Wow. Wait, so, and you bought that condo out here?
Yeah, in Aliso Viejo.
That's so cool. So you bought that condo here, and then you were like, oh my gosh, I can make a lot of money getting into real estate. So then did you just start getting your real estate license?
Just started getting my real estate license while I was still in the Marine Corps.
Wow. Okay. Oh, so you were still in the Marine Corps at this time?
Yep.
And then when did you end up getting your license? Was it during the Marine Corps?
I got my license while I was in, and I interviewed at First Team, actually. I interviewed at Century 21 Beachside. And First Team, the only thing that I loved everything they said, but it was like this big group setting, and there's a ton of people in there, and it wasn't as personal.
Yeah.
And I went down to Beachside, and I met with, you know, I was in a conference room, and there was two people for just me.
Yeah.
And I was like, wow, there's two people here for just interview me. I was like impressed. And they were, you know, they wanted me to work there. And I was like, wow, you want me to work here?
That's cool.
Awesome.
Yeah.
So I was like, okay, I'll work there. So I started in Beachside, and I got out of the Marine Corps, and I had saved up all my vacation. They call it leave. And when you take your leave at the end of your enlistment, it's called terminal leave. So you can save up enough that you can have like 60 days of terminal leave, meaning you get paid by the Marine Corps for 60 days after you get out.
Okay.
So I had 60 days saved up, and I had no money. I had no backup. I had like nothing.
Yeah.
And so
you spent it all on everybody else's dog food.
Yeah. I spent it all on dog food. So I had 60 days to make money, or I was
out,
you know? So I was a big cold caller. I would get the crisscross directory, you know, at the time, where I would just, we'd have a listing, like Beachside would have a listing on a street, and I would call everybody on that whole neighborhood and tell them about the listing and if they were interested in selling. And I got people that wanted to sell and people that wanted to buy. And I probably had my first escrow in 2 weeks, maybe.
Also, I think that's like, something that I don't want to skip over. That time you didn't have dialers.
Oh no, there's right? no dialers. Like,
there's no dialers. You're hand dialing like, all
no,
of those.
That bad.
The rope.
Yeah, that would take you forever.
So you hand.
There wasn't even cell phones. We didn't have cell phones.
Yeah, you had to be in the.
You
office
had to be in the office, dialing. And you're dialing for dollars. Yeah.
And so you just dialed, and then you said within 2 weeks you got your first escrow.
Yeah.
What was the price of that?
I think it was a $100,000 condo in Laguna Hills.
$100,000 condo in Laguna Hills. And like, again, I don't know if you know these numbers, but like, how many dials were you doing on a daily basis at that point? Or hours, let's say.
I mean, I would spend all day in office prospecting. So it was like, but I had different things that I did so I didn't get bored. So I would do like circle dialing, and then I would do like for sale by owners. And then I would cut out the Penny Saver ads and the for sale by owner and like glue it into my book. It's like, now that I look at it, it's like, I can't even believe how annoying that was to do everything on paper. Cause now like I hate paper. Like, everything has to be electronic. So I did my circle dialing, my for sale by owners, expired. It's like, so I would break up the day into like maybe four different prospecting things, and then up desk, cause we had an up desk.
Yeah.
And so I 8 hours a day, I was the first one in the office and the last one to leave, and it was all prospecting. So it's the 2 weeks is like kind of a long time when you're doing that for 8 hours a day. I mean, it really doesn't take
exactly.
much.
Yeah, no, but it's. Option.
Yeah, I had no other option. Right. I had to get an escrow. I had to get paid in 60 days.
Yeah.
Or I would have had no money.
Wow. That's such an interesting concept now that I'm thinking about it. Like, because nowadays, I think about agents that aren't, they go and they find Uber or they find other little things that they can do, but that wasn't available at that time. So like, you had to do something or else this thing doesn't
come. Or I wouldn't have been able to pay my mortgage. I had a mortgage.
Yeah.
Tell you about that.
That's amazing. And maybe at that time, if there was other options, you would have tried to go do something else versus just lean in and focus all in on real estate, which is pretty freaking cool. So then you got your first escrow, you're doing that, and then all of a sudden you became the CEO of First Team. And
The rest is history.
No, like, so you did that, and then as you went through there, what made you, because you ended up starting your own, you got a franchise, right?
Yeah.
So like, how long from your first deal to the franchise was that?
So I got into real estate into the Marine Corps in 93. No, yeah, I was in college for 2 years. And then I got into real estate when my enlistment was up in 97. And then I think I started my company in 2001. So four years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
in that 4 years, what I did was like investing. So I got into real estate investing.
Oh, and
I didn't think I was going to start my own company. I thought I was just going to own a bunch of properties. But I ended up buying, probably it was like in, let's see, it would have been maybe before 2000 or 99, 2000. I had bought a couple properties.
Yeah.
And condos, and I think I had one house. And then I was like, why buy like one condo at a time when I could just buy an apartment building? So I started looking at apartment buildings, and I found a guy up in Long Beach that had some apartment buildings that were in foreclosure. So, and I think I was like 22 maybe at the time or something.
Yeah.
I call him, and he never called me back, but I kept calling him. Finally, he picked up the phone one time, and I said, I saw that you had an apartment building and it was on Elm Street. And I think I said, I saw that it was in foreclosure, and I think I have a solution for you. I want to meet with you. He was like, okay. So we met at Polly's Pies on Atlantic up in Long Beach. And I said, this is what I want to do. I want to buy your building. I know that you owe this much on it. I want you to carry the difference between what I think it's worth, what I think it's worth this. So you owe this. Carry this, and I'll buy it for this. I'll operate it, run it for 5 years, get you out of all the trouble. He's in a lot of trouble with the city for like health code violations and a bunch of different violations. It was yellow tagged, and the city was going to shut it down if it didn't end up going into foreclosure. So I said, I'll fix it up and we'll split the appreciation in 5 years. And he said, I don't know why he said okay, but he said okay.
Yeah.
And I you know, I only had enough money. I was making money, good money at the time, but I only had enough money to pay like his back payments and like fix up the building.
Yeah.
So he said, okay, I made his back mortgage payments. We did a deal and I started working on fixing up the building. And then he sold me 4 other buildings.
So I know a little backstory on this, but you started doing that and you, and the reason I'm going to bring this up, because I think it's important, but like you went that day, right? To pay his back taxes?
Yeah. I went that day to pay his back mortgage payments before we actually had more than, we just had a handshake.
Yeah.
We didn't have anything on paper, which now I'm like, I would never do that again.
Yeah.
But, it's funny, we became really close. His name's Jim, and older gentleman, and he'll still call me to this day and just be like, just want to see how you're doing. And
that's amazing.
Yeah.
Well, it's so interesting, because the reason I wanted to bring that up is because it really shows like your character and who you are, because you are very much a person of integrity. When you say, hey, something's going to be done, it gets done.
Oh yeah. Oh, I'm huge about my word. I just realize over the years that not everybody else is.
Yeah, so exactly.
You know what I mean? Like, you just assume everybody's like you.
Yeah.
You know, and I think over the years I've learned that, oh, there are people that go back on their words, so you should probably get everything in writing.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. That's, and I'm very much the same way. That's why I want to bring that up, because I believe that that's a big piece of what's gotten you to where you've been.
Oh yeah,
like
too.
The ability to be able to be like, hey, this is what's going to happen, and this is when it's going to happen, and then you execute on it, is I want to say a gift. It's a choice. It's a talent. It's all of these things that like get successful people to where they're going to get.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of people that say they're going to do something, and then
most people
don't, exactly,
say they're going to do something, and not even like they're going back on their word, but even like, you know, they. I would always do this with people, like, especially, I hate to throw him under the bus, my husband. Like, he says he wants to do something, and if I don't agree with doing it, I just like, okay, honey. But I know he'll probably won't do it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, there's just, most people don't do it. Most people don't. But he knows opposite. So me, I'm the opposite.
Yeah.
He knows if I say I want to do something, he better, like, object like strenuously right at that moment, because he knows that if I say I want to do something,
it's done.
I'm gonna do it.
Yeah.
So like, if you have any objection,
bring them now.
Like, bring it now.
Because if not, it's done.
Yeah.
I love that, and that's amazing. And going to kind of bringing it back here, you ended up buying multiple properties from this guy.
Mm-hmm.
So you wanted to just be a real estate investor.
Like, yeah, I thought this was. Awesome. I'm going to be an investor and just keep accumulating properties. And now looking back on it, that I should have went that route. But it wasn't, nothing's ever as easy as I think it's going to be in my head. You know what I mean? Like, I always, the reason I always take all these risks and do a ton of things, kind of like fire ready aim, because I do that a lot. Is I always think, well, how hard could it be? How bad could it be? And so I'll take these risks, I'll do these things, and then realize, like, this is harder than I thought, like the pet food delivery thing.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So even the apartment buildings, it was really hard to collect the rents. It was really hard to, get bad tenants out and good tenants in, because good tenants didn't want to be there when there were bad tenants in. So you kind of had to, like, get the whole building out and restart from scratch, and that was really expensive. So it was harder than I thought. I operated them for about 3 years, and I went to Jim and I said, I think it's time we should sell. And he agreed, and we sold them. We split the appreciation. We did really well. We would have done, obviously, a lot better if we kept them longer.
Yeah.
But at that time, I thought what would make me happy would be helping other people build these careers, because I came from a very working class, you know, single parent household. And, you know, we didn't have, we were fine, but we didn't have a lot. And then I joined the Marine Corps, and then I even had less than that.
Yeah.
And then I really loved the idea that real estate, you could have like no background in anything and no, you know, rich parents or no political clout, and you can really build a sustainable wealth business, you know, yeah. like you can build these amazing businesses.
Yeah.
So I was so kind of in awe with that, that I really thought the best thing for me to do would be help other people do it. And that's
that.
When I got kind of out of being an agent and into being an owner.
And so you opened a franchise?
I opened as an independent first.
Okay.
But very quickly, I knew I couldn't grow it. It was like just my name. So I went to like every franchise and I was like, I want to do a startup. And most of the franchises were like, we don't do startups. Like, you know, Century 21 and... There wasn't as much. Remax, ERA, Coldwell Banker was all owned by NRT. So most of them wouldn't do startup. So ERA was the easiest one to get because they were like kind of non-existent out here.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, it's good that they're non-existent out here because I can make them into the brand that I want them to be instead yeah. of having a reputation of the brand they've already created. So I convinced ERA to sell me a franchise. And then for 10 years, I operated that franchise.
Wow, okay. So, and you had that franchise, and then what ended up happening that you, because you went back to independent afterwards, right?
Yeah, so I had the franchise, I recruited,
yeah.
and that's all I did all day was recruiting. I think when sometimes I would go into the marketing meetings and agents would like run away because they're like, oh, here's Michelle, she's gonna try and recruit me. I was like, you know, it was like all I did. And I grew it organically to about 300 agents in Orange County.
Okay, wait, so hold on. So you started this franchise and then a lot of people wish they can grow something to 300 agents, right? Whether mm-hmm. it's independent, whether it's like, what is that? Like you said, all you were doing was recruiting. So you own the company and then you just started just organically, what?
Yeah.
Talking.
I mean, that's not all I did. I was the recruiter. I was the accountant. I was the IT person. I was the marketing. I was like everything.
Yeah.
I got like one person on staff when I first started, like a receptionist who
wow.
did a lot.
Yeah.
And, but I would spend my day just like I did when I was in real estate on the phone. I would cold call. I would go to marketing meetings. I was relentless.
Yeah.
You know, like, and people were kind of drawn to me for one reason or another. They liked, you know, what I had to say. So, you know, they would interview with me and I would say, you know, what does it have to take to get you over here? And we would make it happen. And then just one at a time. Yeah. We
wow.
Just
that's impressive. So 300 plus agents. And then
I went into San Diego. So okay. What happened was ERA kind of saw how well I was doing and they said, we want to give you money to buy other companies. And I was like, hot diggity, let's do that. Yes. So they did. They gave me, they call it developmental advance money, Dan money. It's really Satan's money, but because it gets you into trouble later on. But they gave me money and I bought a company called Sterling. They were in Rancho Santa Fe and Encinitas.
Yep.
And like two offices and very small, probably not worth the money I paid, but it was their money. So I was like, okay. And then I bought a company called Ranch and Sea Real Estate, which was a bigger, good, well-run company with a property management division. And they were in Oceanside, Carlsbad, and La Costa.
Okay.
So then I was up to like 600 agents. I bought a company called City Hall Realty in San Clemente. And I would just like, I'd say, you're going to give me money, I'll buy whatever.
Yeah.
And it just grew until about 2008. And then the shit hit the fan.
Yeah.
And it was just like, it just, the spigot just turned off. I remember it was October 2008. And I was sitting down there. At this time now, I had a bookkeeper.
Yeah.
So I was like, I wasn't doing everything myself. Sitting down there at my bookkeeper and I'm like, where's all the commission checks? And she's like, there are none. And I was like, where are our pendings? She's like, we only have like this amount. And it was like, it just like turned off. It was like gone. Like,
wow.
No money coming in. And I was like, oh crap. And I didn't have like a big, I didn't save a lot. Now I know, but sometimes you have to learn the hard way.
Yep.
So I didn't have like a big cushion at all. So I was like, okay, all right, so I need to start closing offices and I need to start negotiating with landlords. And you can't just like close an office.
That's yeah,
like,
exactly.
A lot of people don't realize. Like the landlord isn't gonna just let you out of the lease.
Yeah.
So I just kind of got organized, made a spreadsheet, you know, found all my landlords. I didn't have a lot of debt besides ERA,
yeah.
who gave me all that money, that wants a return on that money, the landlords, and then all my payroll. So I had to lay people off that I didn't,
yeah.
that I loved, you know, and that I cared about. And I had to negotiate with landlords and say, you know, this is a really bad situation and this is all my, you know, expenses and this is what my income is right now. And some of them were like, okay, we'll let you out of the lease. And some of them were like, no, too bad. So ERA was like, too bad. They literally, I tried everything. Like, how about we go on a payment plan? How about, you know, you take less?
Yeah.
I'm making less. How about we figure this out? And they're like, nope. They basically forced me to sell off my San Diego operation to another ERA. And with that, my profitable property management company, because that was like the only thing kind of that had cash flow coming in.
Yeah, because, yeah.
But they claimed that was under their franchise agreement. So I really didn't have a choice. They had many, many, many lawyers. And my lawyer was like, you got to do whatever they say because, you know, they got you over.
Yeah.
So I did. I sold off San Diego. I ended up having to go bankrupt.
Wow.
Which was really sad for me because I never, like, complete failure to me. My lawyer told me, because then ERI sued me for future franchise fees.
Wow.
Which is in the millions. And my lawyer said, you could fight it and pay me $1 million to fight it, or you have like, you don't have anything, you know, to go after.
Yeah.
I mean, I had a house, but my house was, you know,
instead, yeah.
pretty much, you know, I didn't have that much equity in it. So he's like, just go bankrupt, Michelle. So I did. It was sad.
Yeah.
Like it hurt, you know, it was like, ugh. But, you know, did that. And the next morning I was like, all right, now it's time to start again.
Wow. So wait, so you did that happened. And then like you said, the next morning you're like, start. Was it really the next morning?
It was pretty soon. It's like, I right. couldn't like go that long without a paycheck. So it was pretty soon after, you know, I went through that I was like, what am I going to do?
Yeah.
I mean, am I going to go get a job, like a regular job? Hell no.
Yeah.
Like, I love this business. I love this industry. Like, wow. I love what I was doing. I just didn't do it smart. I was not smart in the fact that I took so much money from them without even taking into consideration that the market could crash or change.
Yeah.
That the market could crash or change was like outside of my like mindset at all.
Yeah.
Like, exactly. I've never been through a crash before. I thought when I was making whatever, like this amount a month, I thought that's what I made a month. And I think we get that way as real estate agents, you know, too. Like you're bringing in like $20,000 a month. You're like, I make $20,000 a month.
Yep.
I'm like, no, you make $20,000 that month. That does not mean you make $20,000 a month. 100%. It could shut off at any time.
Yeah.
And I didn't realize that. I had no idea of that. So I didn't save like I should have. There were so many mistakes I made. I had big offices that I didn't need to have. So I definitely was like, okay, now I'm going to do it again.
Yep.
And I'm going to do it better.
Wow.
And I did.
So then you started, that's when you started the independent.
Yeah.
Or did you, okay. So after that, did you go back into like production?
No, I never went back into production. Never went back into production.
You went straight into, let me build
the
company. Cause you know how
straight
to
into
it.
Recruiting. Cause I knew that's what I was good at.
Yeah.
So I called all the agents that were with me at ERA and I said, this is what I want to do. I want to start an independent. I called a guy, his name is Frank McDowell, who owned Star Real Estate in North Orange County. And I said, Frank, I have a proposal for you. Let's meet. It's like a gym thing over again. He's like, who is this chick?
Common trait here.
So we met, and I said, you have a great business. You're all North Orange County, Huntington Beach, Fountain Valley. I'm all South Orange County, Mission Viejo, Aliso Viejo, San Clemente. Let's do an agreement where we can share services.
Yeah.
I can piggyback on your name and your brand, because he built an amazing brand. And we'll, you know, kind of work it together. We'll have two separate companies, and I'll pay you a trademark fee. And he was like, okay, let's do it. So I started Star Real Estate South County. And I recruited again. A lot of my ERA agents came over.
Yeah.
So I got it quickly to about 150 agents.
Wow.
And we did well. I started my own escrow company, started my own mortgage company. And then I sold it to First Team about 5 years after that.
Wow. Mm-hmm. So then?
Yeah. No, it wasn't 5 years, because that was probably 8 years. Yeah, eight years after that.
So you had this agreement, this independent, then why did you, like, how did the First Team thing come up in the first place? Like, you had your company, and then you were doing well. How many agents did you have when you sold?
I think I had about 150 when I sold.
So then you had this 150, and then, like, First Team comes and says, hey, sell me your company. Why did you say yes?
So, yeah, I mean, it's kind of like the First Team called me and said, I got a proposal for you. Yeah. Let's meet. And I was like, I've heard that story.
You're like, before. I know that line. I'll take the meeting.
Sure. I'll take the meeting. So we met, and I was really impressed with all the things that First Team did for its agents. And I kind of looked at, like, the technology, the systems, the marketing department, the legal department. I was like, wow, that's a lot more than what I'm doing for my agents. And I almost felt bad about it, you know? Yeah. And, but I wasn't sure. And they kind of, it was Rich at the time, and Michael, he was like, you know what, if you came work for us, we'd make you the broker, you'd be a regional VP, you'd have, like, you know, these offices you'd be in charge of, just like you're in charge of offices now. And I'm like, okay, but my biggest fear was, like, being micromanaged in the military kind of thing.
Yeah,
like,
yeah,
that.
Yeah.
I said, tell me how that would be as far as, like, would I still be able to do my own thing, make my own decisions? And they convinced me. And they were actually honest. You know, I don't think they meant to be honest.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we know about him. But it was true. Like, yeah. The offices are very independent, and their managers and regionals have a lot of say over how they want to do things.
Yeah.
So it's a very entrepreneurial company.
Yeah.
It was not bureaucratic. There was no, like, you know, had to fill out these forms and do these spreadsheets at the end of every month and every quarter, nothing like that. So it was really cool. So I made a good decision, but I was very fearful of that.
Yeah.
When I made the decision. But they, you know, they gave me more money than I thought I could get for my company. And I thought, this is the opportunity to have an influence instead of over just 150 or 300 agents, to have an influence over 2,000 agents.
Yep.
And I like that idea. And I like the idea of having, like, a team around me.
Yeah.
Like, before, it was like me, and I was the accountant, and I was the marketing director, and I was the, you know, IT person. And I was even, like, the lawyer most of the time, until it got bad enough where I had to pull in outside counsel. So now I could do what I'm doing and have somebody I could talk to and be like, I need a marketing piece. I need legal help. I need somebody from IT to come down to my office and hook up a printer. I have somebody else to do that. That was like, and I could just spend my time growing this.
That's amazing.
Which is what I really love to do, is, like, grow.
Yep.
So it was, like, intriguing, and it was nerve-wracking, because it's giving up your independence.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, it's exactly.
Yeah.
It's a scary thing, because you feel like, if I do this, do I get to do everything else?
Yeah.
Right?
Like, that's what I want to do.
Yeah, exactly. Because that's really what, it's why you become an entrepreneur, is to be able to not have to worry about everybody else. You just do what you do best, right?
Yeah.
Or what you want to do, right? It's like, what is it saying? It's like, became an entrepreneur so that I didn't have to go in for a 9-to-5. So I work from 6 to 6, you know,
exactly.
You know what I mean? Like, yes, you work more hours, you know, but it's so I can make the decisions.
Yeah.
And then, so you did that, you came over and you were regional VP. Is that what you said?
Yeah. I managed the Mission Viejo office. I sat in the Mission Viejo office. And I was a regional over Mission Viejo, Lisa Viejo, San Clemente.
And then talk to me about like what that, like you're the CEO now. Like you
like
run.
How did that happen?
Like how did that happen, right? Like how did you go from being, you know, managing an office, you know, where, you know, 10 years before you claimed bankruptcy to now you have, now you're the CEO. Like, how did that succession happen?
So when I came over, I was also the broker of record.
Yes.
And I really was pretty vocal about the things I thought the company should do and should not do. Because, and I think the reason I'm so vocal and I don't want to say I don't care what people think, because I think that's not totally true. I do care what people think. But I don't hide my opinions.
Yeah.
And I think the reason why that is because I was my own boss for so long. So I never had to suffer through politics.
Yeah.
Of like being at a company and having to care what people thought that were above you or, you know what I mean? So I've always been very transparent and always been very open with my opinions. And I'm really grateful for that. I'm really grateful I didn't get started at like in a corporate environment, because I feel like that would have squashed that, you know? So I was very vocal. And I think Cam like noticed that, and my ideas were good. And there were, you know, I didn't just come up with ideas either.
Yeah.
Like I said about my husband, like if I came up with an idea, it was gonna get done.
Yeah.
Like you just tell me yes, and then it's getting done. And I think that was noticed. And when Michael Mann and Cam had their falling out and Michael left the company, there was a hole there. And I told Cam, like, I want to fill that hole. Like, let me do that. And he'd never before had a woman in a position like that.
Wow.
You know, it's always been, you know, Bill Plattos and Michael Mann. And, you know, there's several names, but they're all men that have been in that spot. And I think he was really happy that he made the decision, because after when we started working together really closely, he's like, Michelle, it's such a breath of fresh air to work with you because you don't have the ego. Like all those guys that I had in this position had these egos, and it was always like butting heads, you know, they were always butting heads. And Cam and I get along so well because I don't think I have an ego in the way that maybe a man does necessarily. Like, not that I'm not competitive and aggressive and, you know, very even ambitious.
Yeah.
But I don't do things just for the sake of the way they look. Or, you know what I mean?
Or just for to be make right. Make myself feel good. Yeah.
Or make myself feel
good. Yeah.
You know, so we just got along really good. And I think after he hired me for about a year, he's like, man, why didn't I get women into these roles sooner? And then he bought on Gila, you know, as the first female legal counsel. And I think he's realized, like, he's been missing out.
Yeah,
you know,
women run the world.
Yeah.
That's literally,
I think women in general are much more, we develop consensus.
Yeah.
And we're usually not as, like, my way or the highway kind of people. We're like, let's figure out how to do this together kind of people. And that's a very general statement. It's not always true necessarily, but I think he's really like appreciated that. So then when all this came up, where we were going to do this rebrand and we were going to, you know, kind of move the company in like a whole different direction, he thought, you know, this is the perfect time, Michelle, for you to step into that CEO role.
I love that.
Nobody's ever been the CEO of First Team besides Cam.
Yeah.
It's always been him. And for him to have that like kind of trust in me and to believe in me that much is like I will run through fire to make sure that I'd never let him down.
So how did that feel when you first heard about it? Because I'm sure like you had the thoughts of like, oh my, like hell yeah. But then did you have thoughts like, can I do this?
Oh no.
I'm just curious, yeah.
No, I don't have those thoughts. But I guess that's a good thing. Like
Yeah.
maybe I'm just lucky. Like I
Yeah.
don't have very many like limiting beliefs. Like I think I've been doing this for so long.
Yeah.
And I know what needs to happen and I know I can get it done.
Yeah.
Like so there's nothing in even an inkling of not being able to do it. I think I know myself enough to know, like, I'll do whatever it takes. Like, whatever it takes. And you can't tell me it can't be done.
Yeah.
Like, there's a way to get it done. And, whether, it could be like you have to walk for 20 miles to get there.
Yeah.
And nobody wants to walk for 20 miles, but I will walk for 20 miles. Like, I will walk for 100 miles. I will walk for 1,000 miles.
Yeah.
Like I don't know where the motivation comes from. I'm so lucky, I think, but I am so stinking motivated. I wake up every morning
I love that.
motivated. I will do whatever it takes. Like you can't not let me do it. If
Yeah.
I have like a goal of what I want to attain, I will do whatever it is to get it.
Yeah.
And barring like hurting somebody.
Yeah.
Unless that person like deserves it.
Yeah.
But like I'll do whatever. And I think people don't have that the mindset or they're not willing to,
Yeah.
not want to sacrifice.
Do you think that came from, were you like that before the Marines?
I think the Marine Corps definitely like enhanced that.
Yeah.
Because you have to do like really hard things.
Yeah.
And there's no like I'm sorry, it's raining out. Do I really need to low crawl through, the mud when
Yeah.
it's raining? I mean, there's no like,
100%.
like, we're not gonna cancel the low crawl under the barbed wire because it's raining.
Yep.
Like, you're low crawling under that barbed wire and you're just gonna be very wet.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And it's
So.
like when we had the obstacle courses, a
Yeah.
lot of the women that I was in boot camp with would look at the obstacle course and say, that's a really long jump. There was one jump, you're on a log, and you have to jump onto this higher log.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like, and if you miss it, you'll fall to the bottom, and it would probably hurt a little bit. So many women would stand there on the log like, I'm scared.
Yeah.
But I saw other people do it. So it's not impossible at all. Like, the people that jumped, unless they didn't jump
Full out. Yeah.
wholeheartedly, made it to the log.
Yeah.
So you have to just jump. You can't like just sit there and forever, you're gonna fail and then you're not gonna graduate boot camp.
Yeah.
Just jump. What's the worst that could happen?
Yeah.
You sprain your ankle, probably. So what? Just jump.
Yeah.
And I think the Marine Corps really kind of like perpetuated that.
Yeah.
Maybe I always was that way, and it kind of made it even more
Well,
so.
it's like this like mental discipline is like I really truly believe it's a practice, right? Like it's like a like you can create, you can make your mind stronger, is my point.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And that's really what we're talking about is like you probably had a pretty strong head, before, and then like the Marine Corps is like, hey, let's, make you even more, right? And that's really what boot camp is probably about, right? It's more a mental thing than anything. It's like getting over and just going, learning that, like, sometimes it's not going to go your way. Mm-hmm. Most of the time, it's not going to go your way.
And there's so many scary things we had to do. There's like walls we had to rappel down and ledges we had to jump off of into water and, like, you know, swimming with your camis on and your rifle and trying not to get your rifle wet. And, like, just so many things that you did that was scary that you, there's no choice, though.
Yeah.
There's no, like, it's like you just had to suck it up.
You have to do it. And so then I feel like, you know, as it goes through, like, as I've been listening, it's like, that's really what your life has really been, is like, you're just like, it's going to get done. Here's how it's going to get done. And we're just going to go do it. And now, you know, going all the way to where you're at now. And that's why I asked that question of, like, you being in the CEO role and, like, was it scary for you? But you've built this mental toughness, I don't know if it's mental toughness or just discipline, mm-hmm. right? Like, it's really just, you just are disciplined and you know, hey, I know what I know. I know how to do it. As long as I'm disciplined, I'll execute on it. And that's really what success is, right? Is discipline and consistency over time.
Exactly.
And I freaking love that. So, like, so now CEO, you became CEO.
October
2023. You've been absolutely crushing it. Since then, what's your plan moving forward? What's next?
I have, like, big, huge goals for First Team. I mean, I look at the company in general as just like this amazing independent. I mean, I love indies, you know? I think they're so much cooler than the Coldwell Banker, you know, no offense to Coldwell Banker, but, you know, the corporate, you know, environment, you know, it's, you know, the VC-backed companies, like, it's just super cool that we're, like, we're independent. We could do whatever we want to do.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no board of directors we have to answer to. There's no, like, shareholders we have to, like, answer to if we do something wrong or whatever. It's just me and Cam. So that, like, it's, we could do whatever we want. And it's so freeing and so amazing. And then, so we can be creative.
I love that.
And we can build the company and grow the company in different ways and different markets and, you know, different strategies.
Yeah.
And it really is, like, I think it's easy to do because we have the vehicle that's already, like, so amazing.
Yeah.
So
what's your big goals?
So our goal for the company, and that's me and the managers and the recruiting department, is we want to bring in $1 billion in incremental GCI. So new people to the company.
Love that.
In 2024. And we've already bought in $300 million in the first 90 days.
Yep.
So I think we'll easily get there. And just grow, you know, and grow, and not just grow for growth's sake, but grow and get better.
Yeah.
Like, I love what we're doing with the training, like all the training we're doing right now. And that was one of my things I talked about in October, when I got on stage and I got promoted, and I talked about getting back to our, like, core of training and being that company that other companies turn to. You know, we're having a training event coming up in a week, and there's other people from other companies signed up for our training event.
Yeah,
because we are the gold standard of training. We always have been. That was before I got here. Yeah. I, you know, I was lucky to inherit that and then double down on it. So I think that, like, growth, not just growth in numbers, but growth in what we offer and what we do.
I love that. I love that. And it's a lot of back to the basics, right?
Like, yeah,
it's a lot of, like, get to your roots as a company, which is, like, so exciting because that's what made this company so successful.
Yeah.
Now it's, and like you said earlier, it's like, it's nice to be on a nimble ship because you can turn it very quickly, right?
Yep.
I love that. I appreciate you making the time to be here.
Yeah,
it was fun. How can people find you and connect with you?
You can find me on Instagram, Michelle Williams Harrington.
Can you spell that?
And it's Michelle, too. I know, I should change that, huh? So it's not so hard. Michelle's with one L. And so Michelle Williams Harrington. And then where else? I do have a blog that I just started that I haven't even, like, put out yet. That you can find. I mean, it's public. I just haven't really, like, said anything about it to anybody. And it's called teamreveille.com. And it's.
How do you spell that?
So reveille is like hard to spell. It's because it's a French word. So it's R-E-V-E-I-L-L-E. So teamreveille.com. And that I put out a message every Monday morning to the troops. And reveille is what the military uses to signal wake up. And it's basically bugle.
Yeah.
That's what reveille is. So I thought it would be appropriate.
I love that. I didn't even know about that.
Yeah.
That's amazing. So I appreciate you. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks.
And I have one last question.
Yes.
If somebody is going through something like you went through in 2008 or something where they're going through this part in their life where they feel like it might be the low point in their life of feeling like failure in their business, what piece of advice would you give them?
So I always looked at very stressful situations, and 2008 was a super stressful situation because I was potentially going to lose everything, at least lose my company for sure. And so I kind of broke things down into, I did this like kind of like hierarchy of stress, I called it. And what I did was I said, well, what's the most stressful thing that could happen in your life? And to me, the most stressful thing was having to kill somebody, you know? And then the second most stressful thing was somebody trying to kill you. And then the third most stressful thing was having a serious health issue. And the fourth most stressful thing was having a serious financial issue. So when I would look at it, my serious financial issue, and I was like, I'm not even in the top three of stressful things. I don't have to kill somebody. Nobody's trying to kill me. And I'm healthy.
Yeah.
So like, I just think you have to look at things in a very logical way. And like, really, when you're going through a stressful time, think about it. How stressful is this really? I'm not going to die. I'm not going to go to jail. I might lose stuff. I might lose my livelihood, but I'm still going to be me.
Yeah.
I'm still going to be here. So just really looking at it in a logical way and thinking about how stressful is this really? I'm going to get through this. I'm going to wake up tomorrow morning.
I love that. I love that. I appreciate you. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks.